Welcome to Lesson 3, Jesus is Coming Again. Let's begin with our remembrance passage, which is Mark 14, verses 22 through 24. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it and gave it to them and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many." Well, we're going to be, as I said, looking at Lesson 3. Our primary text will be Matthew 14. This text is also paralleled in Mark 13 and in Luke 21. We probably won't be looking much at Mark, but we will be making several references to the book of Luke. But here in this last week, we've come to what I think is this quarter's most difficult chapter. Matthew 24, along with the parallels in Mark 13 and Luke 21, is a very challenging text. And as I stated in number one, whether you call it a question or more of a statement, it and its parallels are so often misunderstood. They're misapplied to current events. But as I want to suggest in a moment, I think if we follow the guidepost, we may not get every detail of these chapters, but we can rule out some things, and then we can narrow it down and then begin to get a grasp on what Jesus is really saying. One of the first things that we encounter with this chapter is there are those that see in it the rapture. They see in it the signs that precede the time before the return of Jesus, or, you know, depending on the variation of premillennial belief, you know, just before the great tribulation is going to start and the rapture is to take place, or before Jesus is coming to earth to set up his 1,000-year reign. Well, I don't have to go into Matthew 24 to know that that's not what he's talking about, because the whole premillennial concept, the whole idea of the rapture, is disproved by other scriptures. When Jesus came at the very beginning of his ministry, as we studied last quarter, he said the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It was not thousands of years off. And in the book of Colossians, when he talked to them about how that God had made them saints, verse 12 of the first chapter, he said, "He has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of His love, in whom we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of sins." Those that are redeemed by the blood of Jesus, those that are forgiven, they are currently in the kingdom of God. If we are Christians, we're not awaiting the establishment of the kingdom. We are serving the King right now. John 5, 28 and 29 speaks of the hour coming when all that are in the graves hear His voice and come forth. Not the rapture when only the righteous are brought out of the graves, but everybody comes forth. Some to the resurrection of life, some to the resurrection of condemnation. So we can rule out from Matthew 24 that he's talking about signs preceding the rapture or the establishment of the kingdom. That's already happened. But the question becomes, is he talking about the final second coming? Or is he talking about the destruction of Jerusalem? Or is he talking about both? There are some who believe that this entire chapter is devoted to the subject of the destruction of Jerusalem. There are some who are known as preterists. For those not familiar with the term, it's P-R-E-T-E-R-I-S-T-S, preterist. They are also sometimes referred to as AD 70 believers, or believers in realized eschatology. They believe that all the prophecies of Scripture were fulfilled in and around the destruction of Jerusalem, or that was the completion of all prophecies, there's not going to be an end of the world. There's not going to be another coming of Christ. That was the final, that this world just continues on indefinitely. There are others who reject that notion. They believe there will be a second coming. Chapter 25 and verse 31, they believe the day is coming when Jesus will gather all the nations before him, verse 32. But they still believe that all of chapter 24 of Matthew is about the destruction of Jerusalem. You know, and I want to make clear this. Not everybody who believes that all of Matthew 24 is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem believes in the so-called AD 70 doctrine. For there are many brethren like that who would go on to say in chapter 25, he's speaking of something that is yet future. One thing, there is another view that I want to make mention of. You can find these at the CEI bookstore, the set of truth commentaries. Kyle Pope, in his commentary on Matthew, argues that in Matthew 24, Jesus goes back and forth between the second coming that is yet future and the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 that's already taken place. In his commentary on Luke, it would seem that Colley Caldwell takes a very different view and believes that all of this has reference to the destruction of Jerusalem up until a certain point in the chapter, at least. I certainly would encourage you, if you have access to the book or want to gain access to it, to read what Brother Pope has to say about it. But I believe that view is probably mistaken. At this point in my studies, what I believe is that up through verse 34, we have the destruction of Jerusalem in view. Then, as we get into the latter part of it, I do believe that Jesus begins to move toward talking about his final coming. Let's just look, though, at what I talked about, the guidepost. First of all, the destruction of Jerusalem is a main topic. Anybody who fails to see that and thinks that this is all about some yet to come great tribulation has missed the context of this chapter. In the 23rd chapter that we looked at in the previous lesson, he talked about how that the righteous blood that was shed on the earth, verse 35, all the righteous blood is going to come upon you. It's going to come, he said, verse 36, upon this generation. He spoke of how that he wished he could have gathered Jerusalem to him. But then he says in verse 38, see, your house is left to you desolate. And as we begin the 24th chapter, Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. Jesus speaks of the destruction of this glorious temple of Jerusalem. And in Luke, it talks about how that they pointed out the decorations that were on it, the elaborate stones. You know, they're showing him this, and he says it's going to be destroyed. And they get out to the Mount of Olives, verse 3, and the disciples said, tell us, when will these things be? He's just said, this temple is going to be destroyed. When will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? When is this going to take place? It's ironic to me that as Jesus is telling them this glorious temple you're pointing to, and you're showing me these great donations that adorn the walls, the great stones. He said, this temple wasn't even completed yet. You may recall that in the second chapter of John, in verse 20, when Jesus, speaking of himself, said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. They thought he was talking about the temple at Jerusalem. And the Jews said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? About 19 BC, Herod the Great had launched this great renovation of the temple, and it continued on after his death. And at the time that Jesus is saying this, they were still working on it, still doing. Oh, it was glorious and fabulous, but they would work on it for another 30 years or so. In fact, it wouldn't be completed until AD 64. Now you think about that. Let that year sink into your head. AD 64. In AD 70, Titus and the Roman armies would burn this temple, level it. They would completely destroy it. All these years of its rebuilding, remodeling, really, and then it would be destroyed just 6 years later. But they asked Jesus about this. And in verse 34, he says, assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. In my mind, this is the second great guidepost. The first is, he has just said, all the righteous blood that's been shed from Abel to Zechariah is going to come on this generation. Your house is left desolate. This temple is going to be destroyed. That's the beginning point. Verse 34 says, all of this is going to happen within this generation. I think that points to, as challenging as some of the things are in the first 33 verses, that we are looking at a prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, can there be some applications made to things that would happen after AD 70? Of course. But I believe verse 34 has to be taken as the second post that says, okay, we know whatever we've been reading about, it in some way is tied in to what Jesus said about the destruction of Jerusalem. And let me take you back to an Old Testament prophecy for a moment. In 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter, you may remember that David had wanted to build a house for God. And at the very beginning, the prophet Nathan said, great idea, do that. And then God said to Nathan, no, you go back to David and you tell him he will not build the house. His son will build the house, the temple. And look at the prophecy he says. Verse 13, and he said, this is after you have died, David. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. Well, those words of verse 14 in Hebrews, the first chapter, are applied to Jesus. But you keep reading, and it says, if he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the Son of Men. The prophecy that was made through Nathan to David was partially fulfilled in Solomon. He would commit iniquity and be chastened, but the kingdom wouldn't be completely taken away from him. But it would take Jesus to be the perfect fulfillment of that. So, when I look at Matthew 24, even as I see this had primary reference to the destruction of Jerusalem, that doesn't mean there cannot be some secondary applications made to the final judgment. And there may have been in Jesus' mind that intent of it. Now, verse 2, Jesus clearly is saying, not one stone left upon another, destruction of Jerusalem. Verse 16, he talks about those in Judea fleeing to the mountains. You know, these are things that were happening that would involve the Roman army. And in fact, if you want to turn over to Luke 21 for a second. Luke 21, which is the very same speech. In Luke's account, verse 20, he said, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, and he goes on to say, if you're in Judea, flee to the mountains. You know, get out of here. I believe the first 34 verses were preparing them for that time when Jerusalem would be surrounded by the Roman armies, that what had been viewed as God's house since the return from captivity was going to be destroyed. He's preparing them for that. But I believe that after that, as we get into the end of the chapter, that he is transitioning us to something that would come without warning. That he would come to reward and to punish. And just as I believe the first part of the chapter is speaking of the destruction of Jerusalem and can yet have some application to us today, looking forward to the final judgment, as he transitions into the final judgment, his second coming, I believe there were some applications they could even make in the first century to God's judgment that was coming upon the Jewish nation. So, prophecy is often that way. That there is the primary application fulfillment, but God often made it where there could be a secondary application of it. Well, let's look at the text and try to read this. They say, Jesus has said, not one stone left upon another. Well, tell us more about this. When's this going to be? What will be the sign of your coming? Read with me verses 4 through 14. And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end would come. Now notice what he says to them. Don't be troubled when you hear things about wars and rumors of wars. Those kinds of things were common in Palestine. There was always unrest. There were rumors of wars that were going to start. And he says, some are going to try to link this to the Christ has come back, verses 23 and 24. There are going to be the false prophets that will take advantage of these rumors and tried to deceive people. But he said, that's not the end. And he said, there will be earthquakes and famines and pestilences. Well, these kind of things have happened throughout time and would continue to happen. He said, yes, there's going to be some difficulties to face. And there's going to be all manner of lawlessness. And what you see Jesus warning about is there will be lawlessness. There will be betrayal, verse 10. There will be those who hate. Look at Luke, the 21st chapter, that parallel passage. He says in verse 12, they will lay hands on you, persecute you. They'll be delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. And he added, it'll be an occasion for your testimony. But there was going to be persecution. There was going to be all kinds of lawlessness and wickedness. There were going to be false prophets. And he says, don't let these things cause you to stumble. You've got to have, verse 13, endurance. In Luke's account, he says, by patience, possess your souls. If you endure to the end, you will be saved. I think there is maybe some application to be made to saving their physical lives from this destruction. For that's part of what this is about, is how to know the way or when to escape. But again, I want you to look at something in Luke 21. I hate having to turn back and forth too much, but this is one time where the two often provide commentary on the other. In Luke 21, in verse 16, he says, and they will put some of you to death. At the end of the verse, into verse 16, they will put some of you to death, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. Now, think about this. Some of you will be put to death, not a hair of your head shall be lost. Do those seem contradictory? Only if we are talking strictly of the physical body. But when we are thinking of the spiritual, when he says there's going to be all manner of wickedness, in those last years before the Roman armies came, there were assassinations, the wickedness prevailed. There were false prophets. There was severe persecution. But he said, if in patience, you possess your soul. Oh, some of you may be put to death, but the reality is not a hair of your head will be lost. You will be saved. And he says, before this end comes, the gospel is going to be preached to all nations. But notice verse 14, what he says, as a witness to all the nations. The gospel preached as a witness. And I think that expression, as a witness, is significant here. In AD 70, when the Roman armies led by Titus destroyed Jerusalem, people had been told for 40 years this was going to happen. As the gospel is preached and the story of Jesus is told throughout Judea and Samaria and Galilee and Syria and Asia and Macedonia and Achaia and wherever, the story of Jesus is told. And included in the story of Jesus is his telling of what was going to happen to this glorious temple at Jerusalem. It would be more evidence that Jesus was the one with all authority, that he truly was, as he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He was the truth. And so the end would come. But we are speaking of the end of Jerusalem, of Judea. And in verse 15, he has been telling them, you're going to hear wars, rumors of wars. There's going to be persecution. There'll be a famine here. Now that's not the time to leave. But he said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, in Luke 21, 20 and 21, he said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the armies. I want you to go back to Daniel for just a moment. I want you to see something in Daniel 11 where this abomination of desolation is referenced. Daniel 11 is speaking of the king of the north and the kinds of things he would do. Verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. I believe if you take Daniel 11 and you study its context, what is being referenced here, the taking away the daily sacrifices, placing the abomination of desolations, had reference to something that happened about 167 BC, when Antiochus Epiphanes, the Greek ruler up in Syria, you know, that kingdom that had, it was what was called the Seleucid kingdom that had been taken from Alexander the Great after his death, divided into four parts. The two most significant, the one general was Ptolemy down in Egypt. And the Ptolemies ruled Egypt. That's the family from which Cleopatra came. You know, then up in the north, you had the general Seleucus. And his descendants, those who reigned after him, were referred to as the Seleucids. Well, the one king, Antiochus Epiphanes, he halted the sacrifices in the temple at Jerusalem about 167, set up his own idolatrous temple. It is believed by many that he had a hog slaughtered on the altar there. Then that prompted the Maccabean revolt. Well, I'm saying that to say when they hear the words abomination of desolation, they would have first thought of that which had happened in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. But they recognize it as the idea of that which is idolatrous, that which is evil coming into God's temple. When the Roman armies have surrounded the city, when they have come into God's holy temple, he said, get out of here. And some of us might think, well, that just seems very obvious. But what often happened in times of war is people from the countrysides flee into the cities. They believe that the walls of the city will provide them protection. Jesus tells his disciples the very opposite. He said, if you're in the countryside, get to the mountains. If you're in the city, get out of the city. Don't stay here at all. If you're on the housetop, don't even go back down in to get things for the journey. When you realize it's that time, you get out of here as quickly as you can and be praying. Be praying that it's not a Sabbath when you recognize it's time to flee. In some cities, they close the gates. Jews would restrict travel on the Sabbath. Winter would make, he mentions winter, would have made travel difficulty, or more difficult. Hiding out in the mountains is much more unpleasant during the winter. One who was pregnant, one nursing a baby, oh, what a difficulty this would be. So this is the thing he's speaking of, that which is a physical distress. He said, you pray for the best possible circumstances. In verse 27, or verse 28 rather, wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Now this is a verse that there are different interpretations given of it. In fact, some Bibles and for the word eagle will say, or in the margin they'll say, or vultures. And we think of eagles don't typically feed on the decaying flesh of a carcass like vultures would. But in the Greek language, there was a word for vulture that is not used here. The Roman armies were well known for the standards they held, the signpost, as it were, that the army carried with it with the eagle upon it. And that may well be Jesus is speaking of Jerusalem, this carcass, and he says the eagles are coming as a way of saying the Romans will soon be here. But one of the great challenges in this, if you think about this as the destruction of Jerusalem, and that's the subject he begins with, it's very easy to see it when you think about those in Judea fleeing to the mountains, verse 16. You think about Luke 21 when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the armies. But what about passages like verse 27, the lightning flashing? Verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Somebody said, no, well, see, this is Jesus coming, not the Roman army. And these signs that are in heaven, it has to be more than the destruction of Jerusalem. Well, before we reach that conclusion, let's look at some prophetic language from the Old Testament. Look at Isaiah the 19th chapter. That's a good starting point. Isaiah 19 verse 1. The burden against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. He speaks of a judgment on the land of Egypt, in which the Lord is riding a swift cloud. Well, the Lord didn't literally ride a cloud into Egypt, but he utilized Nebuchadnezzar and later Alexander the Great to bring his judgment upon Egypt. Look at the 13th chapter of Isaiah. Again, you have a couple of, I call them guideposts. Verse 1, the burden against Babylon. He's talking about Babylon. Verse 17, behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. And we know that in 539, the Medes and the Persians are the ones that destroyed Babylon. But look at some of the things that he says in this chapter. Verses 4 through 6. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like that of many people. A tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts musters the army for battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven. The Lord and his weapons of indignation to to destroy the whole land. Here comes the Lord and his armies. But when the Medes came, that was the Lord coming. Not literally, but they were his representatives to bring judgment upon Babylon. It was going to be, verse 6, the day of the Lord. Verse 9, the day of the Lord. When did it happen? It happened when the Medes, along with the Persians, overthrew Babylon. Look at verse 10. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Verse 13, therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. Now, that is language much like Matthew 24. But here in Isaiah 13, he said it's talking about when Babylon falls. When Babylon falls to the Medes, the sun will be darkened. The moon will not shine. In fact, the earth will move out of its place. It was the end of the world for Babylon. It was the end of their world. The sun didn't shine upon them. So when we go to Matthew 24, we don't have to automatically assume because we see the sun being darkened and the various cosmic signs that he mentions, that this is the end of the world. We've seen that before in judgment against the nations. Let me give you one other Old Testament passage, Ezekiel 32. Ezekiel 32 is a lamentation, verse 2, for Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He's going to bring judgment against the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he says, verse 7, when I put out your light, I will cover the heavens, I will make its stars dark, I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. All the bright lights of the heavens I will make dark over you and bring darkness upon your land, says the Lord God. Did these things literally take place? No. But did they really take place? Yes. There is a huge difference in something being real and it being literal. The sun and the moon were darkened in AD 70. Not in a literal way. But God really turned the lights out upon that nation. He brought upon them a great darkness. Going back to Matthew 24, I want to wrap up this first part with verse 31, which, again, it's a difficult one. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now, I would readily grant to you, this sounds like the end of time when God is gathering the elect. But if you look at Luke 21, at this very same point, making the application of this, he says that they were to look up, lift up their heads, for their redemption was drawing near. Look, lift up your head. You know, don't be downtrodden. You know, we say to somebody, don't hang your head. Lift your head up. In the first century, well, between AD 30 and AD 70, the greatest threat to the church, the greatest source of persecution was the Jewish people. Or the Jewish authorities, I probably should say. He said, you're about to be delivered from that. You will your oppressor is going to be judged. And I think that's the figurative idea here of gathering together his elect, that he's rendering judgment upon those who were not chosen. They would not experience the deliverance. They would experience tremendous suffering. Many would die in the siege and battle against Jerusalem. Many others would be sold into slavery. But God's people would be freed from their oppressor. Now, I want to stop there. In the next class, we will finish up 32 through 51. And we will probably do just a little bit of reviewing, reminding ourselves of what we've looked at. But we'll begin to think about preparing ourselves for the judgment that comes for us. But there are four things that I wanted to suggest. And number one is, sometimes it's okay to admit that this is a challenging passage. And when we come across passages like Matthew 24, we need two great qualities. We need humility and open-mindedness. And those two go together. It's easier to be open-minded if we're humble. Don't say, well, I know this is what it says. Be willing to study, reconsider, weigh all the evidence. But second takeaway is, sin will bring judgment upon us. As I've been suggesting, I believe verses 1 through 34 had reference to the destruction of Jerusalem. But why did it come upon Jerusalem? Because of their sin. Throughout history, God has judged the nations. He will judge nations. He will judge individuals. A third thing is, sometimes we neglect the study of the prophets. But you can't understand text like this one if you don't have some knowledge of the prophets. They are invaluable. Go back and read them and pay attention to them. And a fourth thing, and this is one so highly practical. He told them there was going to be persecution, there was going to be suffering, tribulation. He said, you be faithful. We will face different things than what they faced. But we're going to face our share of difficulties. By patience, let us possess our souls. Let us endure to the end that we be saved. Be faithful despite anything that comes against us.